In the Thick of It, a Profit and Loss podcast with Colin Lambert and Galen Stobbs.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to In the Thick of It, Profit and Loss's weekly podcast, where we discuss the latest and biggest news of the week. With me, as ever, is Colin Lambert, Managing Editor of Profit and Loss, and I'm Galen Stobbs, Editor of Profit and Loss. So, obviously, Colin, one of the big items in the news this week was the Brexit vote in the UK, which didn't go terribly well for Theresa May.
Understatement, yeah.
Did it go any better for the FX market, do you think?
I think it did. Yeah, I have to say. But I think, again, this is one of those, another instance where we can identify the known unknown. We all knew that there was going to be a vote. We all knew that Theresa May was going to lose it. The question was how much the defeat was going to be by. So I think that enabled people to calibrate their machines and to be able to turn around and say, okay, so if the vote is X, then we're pricing here and so on and so forth. So I think that enabled the market to just be ready for pretty much any outcome, unless, you know, by some very strange thing she'd have actually won the vote. And I think that might have stuffed things up quite a bit. Trading was very orderly. I mean, I was onto the platforms. Pretty much one platform, especially while the vote was going on, and it was very orderly all the way down, and it was very orderly all the way back up. Plenty of volume. Volume was about 50% higher than normal, according to two of the platforms I spoke to afterwards. And it was because there was plenty of people out there just, you know, saying, okay, I'm happy to trade this event. I think also there was an element of something we've discussed the last couple of weeks around the flash event in January, that human traders now, particularly in this region, are very, very aware of these sharp moves, and they're looking to sort of effectively trigger a mean reversion in the machines, because the machines themselves are mean reverting, obviously. But I think they're looking to trigger these mean reversions, so I think they're probably even more eager to buy into a dip and sell into a rally than maybe they were just a few weeks ago, because they saw what could happen and the value they can get on January the 3rd, the 4th, sorry. So I think what we saw was, you know, we saw it go down a couple hundred points. Buyers were just appearing all over the place. And it handled the rebound well. So,
I was kind of surprised because I spoke to people that day, you know, cause obviously the vote happened about 7 p.m. UK, so 2 p.m. US time. You know, I was doing some interviews with people that day, and I was saying, oh, thanks for taking the time to chat to you today. I know you're probably, you know, pretty busy, all hands on deck. And people were pretty relaxed. Everyone was like, oh, you know, everyone seemed confident that they had everything in place, that everything was going to function smoothly. And to an extent, I think it did. What I would say is, From an event like this, where, let's be honest, it was heavily signaled in the news, at least, that Theresa May was going to lose, plus everyone knew it was going to happen, do we actually learn anything about how the FX market, how technology, how the liquidity, etc., functions from busy but heavily signaled events like this?
I think it's interesting. I think it's actually a negative lesson, if there can be such a thing. I think what it shows us is how badly the FX market handles surprise events now. In the fact that, you know, they've handled this. And I would actually say, you know, looking back over the years, I would say that the modern FX market handles known unknowns a lot better than the markets of old, the manual markets of old, when, excuse me, when there would be some really nasty moves, generally speaking, because there was a lack of information transfer. So I think, it looks to me and say, yeah, I think this market, the modern market, is better at handling known unknowns, but I think it's worse at handling the surprise events, which I think is the big difference between, you know, I guess, like a flash move and a big event vote like this. The only thing I would say is that actually it could just be, as we said a couple of weeks ago, it could just be the speed at which it happens, and that's why we don't think it handles the market, the things that well. It could also be that there's actually a bit of a non-story. I mean, I noticed this morning sterling's about another 100 points higher. And keeping true to form, I think I sort of tweeted at the start of the week, like, you know, just sell Sterling any rally and go home. So obviously I'm sort of, you know, packing my bags as usual. But I mean, to me, that tells me a couple of things. A, I think the market was quite short. And B, I think the foreign exchange market has more faith in the politicians than I do in terms of actually managing to come up with something. I think the FX market is telling the world what the news outlets are coming around to a little bit, and that is that this thing will be delayed or there'll be another vote because they can't see how they're going to get another deal out in time. So it could be the you know, the hard, disorderly or no deal Brexit. I very much doubt it, given the way things are going, and the market certainly seems to think that way. The other thing I thought was quite interesting as well, and you sort of, it's one of those moments when you sit there and you think, you know, you go to work all year and you sell, buy, you're up and down, you're charging around like a lunatic, and you're going home on December 31st and you're thinking, what have I achieved this year? Because Kit Jooks from SocGen tweeted this week that I think it was just after the vote, or it's certainly around the vote, euro sterling was exactly the same level 1 year before. So we've been thrashing around on Brexit. We've been thrashing around in markets for all this stuff. And the net move over a whole 365 days was zero. You do sometimes wonder. So, I think, did it teach us anything? Not really. I don't think there's much to learn from it. I am starting to get whispers, actually, that a few that there's a regulatory authority collecting data on the January 4 event. To see what happened there. So I think, you know, even the authorities are going, look, you know, we know we can, the market can handle these things, what happened on that day. Hopefully they do a better job than the last one where they just looked at post trigger. They need to look at what the triggers are. But yeah, it's one of those things. I think I said this before when we had an event previously before. It was before pre-podcast era, so PP. and I think it's, I think generally speaking, the market gives itself a pat on the back for how it handled it, but I don't think it was actually, it should be that big a pat on the back because it should be able to handle this sort of event, which I thought was interesting. Speaking of events, and it's just material from heaven for you and I know. And I really did enjoy your social media coverage of this. So the JP Morgan Institute this week put out another research paper on the SMB, everyone's favorite central bank, on the SMB event back in 2015. I think your graphic was perfect as well, no-brainer, straight ahead. For those that haven't seen it, do you want to run people through what they said and then we can maybe discuss it?
So basically in June last year, JP Morgan put out a research report looking at the SMB event and basically saying that a lot of hedge funds had executed strategies where they would, you know, buy euro and sell Swiss franc if and when the exchange rate got near the 120 floor, and that this had been going on for quite a while. There was a pattern there, etc. So they build on that, and this new report, the title of which is "Does the Timing of Central Bank Announcements Matter?" Now I don't mean to pour cold water on people who no doubt worked hard and it is very thorough with the data, but I couldn't help but feel like I could have told them the answer to that one in advance. And I'm not claiming any special knowledge there. I feel like most people could have told them that because they go through reams and reams of data and there's graphs and they quantify kind of everything they say. But basically, their end conclusion of this whole report is that, and you might want to sit down or brace yourself, Colin, or listeners at home even. So it turns out that surprise announcements from central banks may, they don't even say definitely, may produce greater volatility than announcements made at scheduled preordained times.
Mm.
Yeah, AKA surprising the market.
The May in there.
Yeah. Got to hedge that just in case, mate. Surprises can create more volatility than non-surprises.
Yeah. I think my favourite line from the report actually was when, I think it was just in the executive summary, and it sort of said, the potential upside for a long Euro-Swiss position far exceeded the downside as long as the SNB defended the exchange rate floor. So what you're saying is as long as there's a bid there for 20 billion euros, you're happy to buy Euro-Swiss. Funny that, I can't think why, yeah. It's this is the problem, unfortunately. I mean, academics work is important to sort of understand how markets function. And I guess if they're talking to other academics, you know, if someone at Swiss National Bank is an academic and they don't get what we're saying, they will understand this. Why would you put the word may in there? Because it definitely did. I mean, what people often forget is that the Swiss National Bank surprised people on the way into this policy as well. They suddenly announced it and said, you know what, we're not going to let it go below 120 back in 2011. And that caused like a 5 or 6 big figure move.
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of interesting to see how they show the data that actually hedge fund confidence in the SNB's willingness to maintain the floor actually peaked 4 weeks before the central bank dropped it. It kind of wavered the year before and then...
Yeah. I mean, that's why I think it was such a magnificent move in its awfulness by the SNB. because not only did they surprise people by doing it between meetings, and this let's be serious for a second. The research is right. The correct way for a central bank to exit such an important policy is having discussed it in a meeting, not literally randomly in the middle of a month. But they sort of kind of lured the market in because what was it 4 weeks before
December 18th?
Yeah,
December 18th, the SNB reaffirmed its commitment to the minimum exchange rate policy.
They cut their deposit rate again.
3 month. They cut Swiss franc 3 month LIBOR into negative territory, which incentivized people even further. To do this strategy.
and then I think it was on the Monday of the event. The one of the SNB directors said, no, we're still going to defend 120. We're committed to this policy. And like two days later, see everybody. Thanks for coming.
Yeah. If you wanted to sit down and figure out a plan to cause kind of maximum pain to people, you would come up with roughly something that looks like this.
Absolutely. What I'm saying. It was just magnificently awful for everybody. It's fantastic.
And the other thing I don't know, right? As in this research, I mean, it's fun to tease it a little bit, but I don't know. For all I know now, that every time someone from the bank or bank associations, etc., goes in to see central banks, they're going to have this research in front of them, which you know quantitatively backs up their argument and reminds central banks of when to do it. Then you know it could have some significant value as something like that. But it did feel slightly. Like making a fairly obvious point, I can't help but feel.
No, I mean, I think as so much of this research does, it was making a very obvious point. And just to reiterate, sometimes you need to make the obvious point. I'm not convinced this is one of those times. I think the SNB also know that they stuffed it quite badly. It's one of those things because, I mean, it's an interesting decision to make. I'd love to have an insight into the thought process of, I mean, really valuable research would be sitting down with the four people, five people concerned with this policy and saying, like, so what on earth were you thinking? Take me through your thoughts. Because, back in the day when they would intervene, when a central bank, I mean, the Bundesbank was particularly powerful at this, a central bank would intervene in markets directly when they were unhappy with either volatility or the level of exchange rate. And it would generally be a surprise. You'd be sitting there, you'd be buying dollar mark, and all of a sudden, bang, the thing's 400 points lower because the Bundesbank just came in and slammed the market. That was a surprise. And that I don't mind because effectively what they're saying is, well, look, we've been warning you verbally that we don't like the Deutsche Mark or the Euro this week, and we will do something about it. And the timing of that's a surprise, and that hurts people, and that gets their attention. That's fine. What really stuns me about this whole thing, and it's not the first time I've said it, is that the only people the SNB hurt were those that were actually supporting their policy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they did not hurt anybody that said, no, they're full of whatever. You know, it's not going to happen. They'll give it up. So everyone that was actually buying the Swiss National Bank's line and saying, yeah, okay, you know, I'm willing to support this central bank, so I think they will hold this line, I believe in their policies, they're the ones they hurt. And the trust levels are just like, yeah. And I guess there's another thing here, which I think research like this should make a point or should try to analyze. And that is the impact on the trust levels between market and central bank. Because quite frankly, as an observer and as a trader, I still would have zero confidence in Swiss National Bank policy statements. Because if I'm sitting there and I've just dropped 25%, which is easily four times my year budget on one event, and for some people it was catastrophic, why would I ever trust that central bank again? And there probably is a knock-on effect to other central bankers as well. So, I mean, there were some serious issues around the SMB event, which I think actually the academics haven't really looked at yet. And I guess because it's hard to quantify things like trust. You know, an academic needs data, and how do they turn around and say, how do we measure this? So, yeah, I mean, it's fun to sort of poke at it. It is good that we still got people looking at these things, but sometimes you just wish they would at least be a bit more positive. I'm with you. The word may have.
Yeah.
Talk to the guy still trying to make that money back he lost that day, whether it's a may. Anyway, moving on from every FX leader's favourite central bank. Interesting announcement this week from HSBC that they'd settled, I think it was $250 billion, was it, dollars
yep.
worth of
yep.
FX trades using distributed ledger technology or blockchain. It's quite surprising although I am hearing more and more uses of blockchain in financial markets, it's quite a surprise to actually hear someone say, well, we've actually done something with it. It's not just a concept.
So really interesting announcement. It caught me off guard because I didn't know that they had a project this big going on. And I've spoken to a few other people about it just in casually and kind of said, oh, did you see that? And they were like, yeah. And I kind of said, did you know that they had this big project going on internally? And lots of people kind of said, no, I had no idea. No, the transactions were all – it was all across HSBC's internal balance sheet. So it was very much an internal project, which is perhaps why people didn't know about it. But yes, it suddenly went for – because I feel like a few years ago, everybody was blasting out, promoting so hard all their blockchain DLT initiatives. And HSBC didn't do that with the FX side. And then, now they've just said, oh, we've already done $250 billion, which is a not insignificant amount. So I thought it was really interesting from that perspective. The DLT solution adds to the illustrious list of great names for products in the FX market. They decided to call it HSBC FX Everywhere.
Yeah.
Let that sink in for
a
moment. There's three benefits they identified to the solution. The first is that they get a shared, single version of the truth of intercompany trades from execution through to settlement, and that reduces risk of discrepancy and delay. Secondly, it means confirmation and settlement is automated by matching and netting transactions. That reduces costs and reliance on external settlement networks. And the third is that DLT provides them with a big, consolidated global view of forward cash flows and certainty of funds throughout the funding cycle, which supports greater balance sheet optimization. Now, I followed up with them this week to find out a little bit, because I was caught off guard by this, to find out a little bit more about the about what the project, the solution, what it's kind of being built for. Now, I spoke to an engineer there, and they talked very quickly, so I need a little bit more time to unpack my notes on this. So maybe in next week's podcast, I'll be able to give you a slightly more detailed rundown on the nitty-gritty of this. But basically, the way HSBC is structured is very much a conglomerate of banks that are run kind of at local levels in some cases. It's very much kind of an arm's length model. And that's why this kind of DLT solution was very good for them. And they found it very useful, because in a lot of places, for example, and I'll get into in the follow-up article again into exactly how they did this, but in a lot of places, data has to be treated in different ways at different local locations. So they basically could set up a system where the data is done according to kind of the native requirements, but then it gets brought into this broader DLT environment so they can kind of view the data more kind of, our favorite word, holistically, which I thought was interesting. But then they started talking about packing metadata around cash flows, and it got a little bit more tricky. So maybe follow up with that one next week.
Well, I think HSBC probably this technology is just a godsend to the bank, because over the years, I think it's fair to say that their EFX franchise, or EFIC franchise if you want, but their EFX franchise has been subpar, not through sort of want of effort, and you know, they've done a lot of work over the past few years on their algos and their pricing, which are now up to scratch, but for many years even their pricing was struggling. And I think the problem was is that, as you say, HSBC is a conglomerate of a bunch of local banks, effectively, all of whom are working on different technologies. It used to be the joke in the FX market that if you wanted to know who run FX for HSBC, it depended on where and who you ask. If you ask Hong Kong run it. If you ask New York, New York run it. If you ask London, London run it. So there's always been this sort of, you know, fragmented structure there. So to get something like this, you know, DLT technology, that can actually help them bring the data into one place a lot more efficiently, a lot smarter, easier and cheaper to deploy, I would imagine that's a fantastic outcome for HSBC. And I would expect some of the other banks out there probably to be doing something similar.
I wonder as well, because we've seen, you know, the big consortiums, whether it's R3 or, you know, digital asset on a consortium, but like, you know, these big, these external groups that like lots of people are signing up to, and they're getting lots of people around the table, and different institutions are going to be different nodes, etc. Not that much has come out of those. So I wonder whether actually, because part of the problem there is, right, if you, they need a private network, getting that many banks around a table to agree on the specifics of the network in terms of what data can and can't be seen by everyone shared is a nightmare. They all have different views on what it should look like. But then once you start getting rid of more and more nodes, it looks less and less like a blockchain. So I wonder whether actually for kind of the big, huge mega banks, doing it kind of internally where all the nodes are all their different kind of satellite offices is actually going to make more sense than this kind of shared infrastructure between different companies.
I think that's the barrier to blockchain technology, is this sort of, you know, you talk about trying to get multiple banks to agree to something. Let's just herd some cats into a swimming pool, because it's going to be easier. Getting these people to agree on most things is really difficult. I think you're probably right. I mean, I spoke to they're a relatively unknown firm to many in the FX space still, because it's still only a couple of years old. But a firm called Drum G that are based in Singapore and that's unfair. They're global. They're in Bermuda, Singapore, London, and they're working on enterprise blockchain around end of day data. And listening to you there, sort of it struck me that, yeah, they went with a bank first up, and the project's gone really well, and the bank's deployed it, and it's really helped them with their end of day data. But they're still pushing for that next level, which is going to be getting another four or five banks in. That's what they're working on now, and that's where I think the sort of, you know, the bottleneck comes, because, you know, there's this reluctance to share anything. It could be all these legal actions that are still floating around, but I think it's more competitive, or it's still people think they can make a difference with it. To me, at some stage, I mean, it's as Tim Grant, he was the CEO of Drum G, said to me, he says, at the moment, you've got banks submitting end-of-day data, which is then cleaned, admittedly, and then they buy it back. So effectively, they're buying to use their own data. Whereas this is exactly why you have an enterprise blockchain, so that, you know, people post to the blockchain, you can do the cleansing on there, and then you have a much cheaper end of day rate. So maybe we're on the cusp. I don't know. My sense is that things like this announcement from HSBC, and there probably will be more to come from other banks, they're the first stage. They will all help sort of, I guess, if you want to sort of put a metaphor out there, build up the pressure on the dam wall as more and more people do this. And at some stage, someone goes, you know what, let's break the wall and let's actually do this together. That will be the big play for me. What do you think it means anything? I mean, it could be that they are the end solution, but what do you think this means for, you know, someone like CLS? Well, I know they're working on their own blockchain solution, but you know, is that where this ends? Is this a threat to them? Should they be worried about banks doing this?
So this did come up in one conversation that I had, and basically the response there, they kind of hedged it a bit, right? Which is they kind of said, well, you know, CLS is still going to play a critical role, and you know, Hurst at risk, and et cetera, et cetera. But what they did say is that perhaps some of the underlying assumptions of the market and how the market is expected to operate are going to change, and firms like CLS and Triana and firms like that, Triana also have DLT initiatives, they can't just ignore that. They need to be able to respond to that.
I mean, it strikes me looking at these things that it's not necessarily a threat to the existence of these firms, because as you say, they're critical market infrastructure, especially in the case of CLS. But I think it possibly is a latent threat to their revenue stream going forward, because we all know, I mean, if this technology works, it is cheaper. So someone like CLS or, you know, IHS Markit and even Triana, if this stuff works, inevitably their costs are going to be lower, and they are going to have to pass that on in lower charges, I would imagine, or else, you know, the customer base will look for an alternative solution. So I guess that'd be one to watch. Moving on, I guess, just briefly, you mentioned last week when we were discussing Chris Kincannon that you were going to the CBOE media briefing. How did that go?
Yeah, so I did go to the media briefing, and for people who don't know, when you go to these official kind of media lunch briefings, they give everybody kind of a booklet which tells everybody how well they've done this year, and then the speakers from that firm kind of go through some of the highlights and tell you in person how well they did that year, and then you get to ask questions. So for me, the most interesting thing was what they actually left off their sheets. Now, to be clear, just looking at from a pure volume perspective, CBOE actually did, FX did have a very good year this year. In our Q1 magazine, we're going to be going through that in more detail and kind of analyzing why they did well this year. But to me, what was interesting is two things that did not get a mention were A, NDFs, considering at the end of December 2017, they launched, you know, NDFs on their CEF, and they were, that was going to be a big push for last year. The other thing was, when I went to the same media event in January 2018, all that anybody talked about was crypto. Now, to be fair, that was driven a lot by the journalists in the room who wanted to, you know, talk about the new shiny thing. But it was very much, you know, they had pages dedicated to that, and they were happy and excited to talk about what they were doing in the crypto space. Didn't even make it onto the highlights booklet this year, and didn't even get brought up until I asked about it, which I thought was kind of significant in and of itself.
There is a sense that CME's done better, isn't there, across the two exchanges?
Yes, I would say, but I would say that, but like not massively.
I think part of it
was because I spoke to some people who like, so the CME is five, the contract there is five bitcoins, the CBOE is one, and when the price was much higher, people liked the granularity of some people did like the granularity of the CBOE one, because for the CME one, if it was when it was at 19,000, right, five bitcoins, that's almost 100,000. Yeah. So the amount of margin, etc., that you would have to post, because you know everybody required tons of margin, etc., you had to post to trade that was a lot, right? So I think in some regards, the price coming down has actually made the SIMI being 5 Bitcoins, the basically the contract structure, a little less of an issue and a barrier to people. But I asked them kind of about these two segments they skipped out, and they were pretty frank that the MDFs kind of just didn't really go anywhere last year. Meanwhile, the crypto problem there, they said, is until there's some form of ETN, exchange traded note, you know, whether that's an ETF or how that's structured, there's limited amount that people can do with just, you know, Bitcoin futures.
Yeah.
And we haven't got that. Now with the US government shut down, everything that was on the table is being delayed. You know, they've got CBOE now has two regulators that aren't picking up the phones. So they still said that they're long term, they're still bullish on the crypto space, but that right now there's not really much they can do except sit and wait for regulatory developments.
Yeah, or hope he goes back to 20,000.
Well, yeah, either or.
It's an interesting one for me. The NDF piece, I think there was always going to be a real challenge for them because you mentioned the word CEF. Well, the rest of the world doesn't care about CEFs. You know, I hate to be the bearer of bad tidings to US regulators, but the rest of the world doesn't care about CEFs. Asian NDFs are the most liquid markets out there, and EBS pretty much owns that market. So I think that's their second challenge is, yes, we saw it with China, but that was fairly early days. But you very rarely see somebody come in and grab significant market share from the incumbents in these, I guess, peripheral markets. And if you look at, you know, I think, was it China's EBS is, I think, does more volume than yen in Asian hours on EBS. So they're going to have a problem, I think, you know, with that NDF challenge anyway. I wonder if it's going to become one of those products for a lot of platforms where they just have to have it. Yeah, because there will be one or two customers who want to trade it. They want to trade everything with CBOEFX. And other platforms are available, of course. But I wonder whether that's, you know, I think part of the problem is it's on CEF and the rest of the world doesn't care about CEF. And secondly, there's a very strong incumbent, and that always makes these markets very difficult to get into. And as has been proven, just cutting prices or giving the trading away for free doesn't actually do anything because you might get a short-term boost, but it becomes uneconomical in the long term. And by then, in this day and age, people are connected everywhere. There's no habit forming. It's not as difficult to break a habit when you're connected to multiple platforms. So it'd be interesting on the crypto side, see how they go with that. My sense is that I think also the bubble has kind of, or sort of the air has gone out of the balloon of crypto to a degree with this move down over the last year. So there's not quite the enthusiasm there was for it. And that's also going to play a part as well, isn't it? You know, if what effectively has happened to me is that crypto markets have grown up in the last year and they've now become a two-way bet. And the minute a market becomes a two-way bet, investors suddenly start to sort of, you know, go, oh, what do I do now? I'm not so sure. So it's less popular because it's not a one-way street. It was interesting to me this week that Citi's CFO, I wrote about it in my column yesterday, sort of said, our fourth quarter of revenues were the lowest since 2011, which is quite significant. And it was because customers are sitting on the sideline waiting for direction. And that told me two things. Firstly, I think the banks generally are over-reliant on their clients. They need to find themselves a structure where they can take more proprietary risk. And secondly, the minute two-way risk is introduced into a market, a lot of clients go missing. And I think that's what crypto markets have faced this year. So it'll be an interesting challenge for them, see how we go from there.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's our time for this week. Thanks, everyone, for listening. So feedback always welcome, as always, and we do appreciate the notes we get dropped by various channels. We'll be back next week. Have a very good week ahead, and we'll speak to you then. Thanks a lot.